Benny Moten was a piano player and band leader in Kansas City's jazz scene back in the early 1900s. He was born in Kansas City, but as you can hear, he and many jazz musicians at the time were influenced by the Afro-Latino sound. That sound has been part of the Kansas City jazz scene and Kansas City culture for a long time, but how that influence and the Cuban influence is felt has changed over time with every wave of immigration. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear from Kansas City musicians and Kansas Cityans with Cuban heritage about how their stories intersect. We have lots of guests, but I want to start by talking to Antonio Marquez. He was born and raised in Kansas City, and his father is from Cuba. Antonio, how did your family end up in the United States?
Oh, man. The family came in 1969. They started with when my father was born in Cuba. They started where they applied to come to the United States, and Cuba at the time would split families up. So what would happen is my grandmother came to the United States, was one of the first of the family to come, and they had my grandfather. He had to go through Spain. So when my grandmother came with my father, they lived in Miami for a few years and then moved to New Jersey. And then my grandfather reunited with them in 1973. So it was that was a very hard time for a lot of Cubans coming to the United States. And
the process was, I mean, you could apply and get permission to come.
Yes. Yeah, so I believe my grandfather applied to come a few years before. And it just so happened that when my father was born, they were given the opportunity to leave, but they wouldn't let them go together. So
have you heard a lot about like the specific circumstances that inspired them to be part of this application process and to uproot themselves and come here?
Yeah, well, it was when the revolution came. So when the revolution came, my family, my grandmother's side of the family had a big farm in Rio Feo. And when the government came in, you know, they took ownership of all that stuff. And so I think they quickly saw that it wasn't the country that they wanted to live in anymore. And so they knew that in order to be able to bring change, you know, they'd have to start on a micro level. So my grandfather took that step with my grandmother to leave, and we have a very big family. So for them to start that process in 1969, and I'd say is about 98% complete in 2004 as far as bringing our family to the United States, was a very courageous thing to do at the time. I think of it now, if something were to happen and we would have to uproot ourselves, you know, under circumstances, I think it would be it's a scary thought. I mean, going to a foreign country, a country that you don't know much about, or you've been told for several years, and in their case in Cuba, that, you know, the Americans were bad and they were doing this to us, and you know, we were gonna bring real change to Cuba and get the corruption out. And you know, I think to think about doing that now in 2016 is very scary. And I think even more so when you think about the times in 1969, the Cold War and everything. I think
how demonized both sides.
Absolutely. It's sort of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't, you know, if you think about it. So it's, do I leave and do I risk it all for this idea of freedom that you don't truly know if is there due to all the propaganda that you're being told in Cuba, or do you stay in Cuba and ride this out and see what happens, you know? And the relationship with Cuba and Russia at the time was very strong. So, you know, there was a lot of people that were a little apprehensive to making those big changes. So, I mean, for my grandfather to do that and then to be separated from my grandmother for as long as he was, and my grandmother basically being here with some distant relatives, not speaking English, not understanding the culture, is kind of crazy to think about, you know?
How did they acclimate?
Well, I think it was for them, I know with my grandmother, it was different. I think she tells me stories all the time, especially when they lived in New Jersey. They managed the apartment building that they lived in. And so they would deal with people and other immigrants and other, you know, just Americans with different issues that would come up with the apartment building. And, you know, my grandfather, he would love to say that he would speak, he would say in Spanish, that he él habla el inglés como Tarzán, you know, so he speaks English like Tarzan, you know, oh, me, you, me, I go, you know, so, and, you know, it's really funny to hear like how they would communicate. But I think, you know, it's funny, they had a genuine appreciation for the United States. And I think what they were given coming here, I think, like I said before, the scary idea of coming to a country that you don't know much about and it's been demonized, and I guess coming out and realizing, hey, you know, you made out great in this decision. You know, I think they have a lot of love for the U.S. because of that, and I think it showed when they lived in New Jersey. And my grandfather, he worked for Ford and was able to work on the line there, and he ended up getting transferred from New Jersey to here, and that's how the family ended up in Kansas City. So,
you know, I'm curious about the role of Cuban culture in your life as the second generation.
Yeah, man, in 2016, it's a very sticky situation. You're kind of stuck in between two ideologies, right? So you've got like the older generation that obviously is very bitter about the situation and what happened to them and why they had to come to this country, which is 100% completely valid. And I could say to a certain extent still is valid.
Can you explain that bitterness a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's the idea of, you know, the revolution for Cubans, you know, and you know, it's funny, my grandfather, my uncle Tati, they were all people that were very, a lot of people in Cuba were for the revolution. I mean, think about the idea of, you know, at the time you had the mafia, you had a lot of corruption going on in Cuba between the Bautista government. And, you know, people want to change, you know, they wanted to see something different in Fidel and Che. They gave grandeur, you know, ideas of what this change could be, and immediately flipped the switch after they, you know, kind of took power. So and there's that's where that bitterness comes in, is that they were for this revolution that actually didn't ever pay dividends. And so the idea of leaving your families, you know, back in a country that, you know, is impoverished and very hard to live in and, you know, very oppressive. I mean, that leaves a lot of bitterness. If I had to leave my family behind, if I had to leave and go on my own by myself, I would feel the same. And I think, you know, I think that's really what it kind of boils down to for a lot of, especially a lot of the older generation in my family, is, you know, they've been wronged and rightfully so. And I think in a perfect world, they would have never left. You know, as great as the United States can be, I think that's their home. That's where, you know, that's where they were born. You know, my grandmother will, you know, tell me stories about, you know, viviendo la finca, and she would talk about, you know, just living on the farm and just what life was like and all the farm hands. And, you know, like that was her world. And to her, that, you know, it's dead. And that idea of death, of that memory, is where that bitterness would come from.
For you, growing up in Kansas City, I mean, did those things feel dead to you too? Or being a little bit more removed from them, did they take on their own kind of life in your imagination?
So, funny you should say that. So, I mean, growing up in Kansas City, you know, we had the Cuban American Association of Kansas and Missouri that was very prominent in the mid-80s, very prominent in the 90s, and kind of dissolved due to just the older generation just getting older and not being able to come in the early 2000s. And so I actually participated in a lot of that.
What did that mean? What kind of stuff did they do?
Well, the cool thing was, is like, I unfortunately never met him, but Juan Nogues was the, I believe he started it, and he passed away, I believe I want to say it was before I was born. So the organization that I grew to know and to love, the people that helped do it alongside my grandparents were, you know, Luis and Luisa Gonzalez, Osvaldo Rojito, and Gloria and Enriquez. And, you know, they were very they were very big in the forefront of trying to bring what that Cuban culture is to Kansas City, but also helping a lot of the Cubans that were placed here, you know, getting them set up with jobs and kind of helping them figure out, you know, where a lot of their government assistance would come from, and kind of just giving them that sense of community, you know. And we would participate in a lot of like the ethnic, the ethnic festival, and we would have, you know, we would do, you know, the food. I participated in a lot of the conga dancing. and doing a lot of the traditional dances and such. And so I was fully immersed into the culture from a young age. And for me, it was, you know, you kind of romanticize Cuba pre-revolution, right? Because you that's what you know. And even though a lot of my family continued to come, you know, I had my cousins, Ivan and Julian, that came in 93. I think 88 was where my other cousins, Adolfo and Diana, and then my aunt, uncle, Miriam, and Tati came. So, you know, I got stories not just from the people that came in 69, but the people that came in the late 70s and the 80s, and just how much things had changed. And so you kind of cling on to those, what those memories are and what those things could be, right? And
the
so
pre-revolution memories.
Pre-revolution. And then post as well, because, like I said, family continued to come all the way up until 2004 when, you know, it's funny, my cousin that we're both closest in age, Wilma Rosa, she came in 2004 with my other cousins. And, you know, it's funny, I only knew her through letters and I never met her. And it was nice to meet her. And, you know, we're very close. And I think, thinking about how this all fits in, like how I view things now is different because I have a perspective of what it was, what it could have been, and now what it actually is, right? So I think a lot of the older generation has a kind of a hard time kind of seeing what that future could be due to the bitterness. And so I think the way that I view it is I see potential where Cuba could be, you know, in the future. But I do think that, you know, they always say that first step is the hardest step to take, right? It's kind of, I liken it to getting together with your ex-girlfriend, right? So, you know, you're real sweet on her for a while there. And then
all your friends are saying, don't go back.
Yeah. And everybody's saying, don't do it. Right. And so you make that first step and it's maybe not the best first step, but you know, it's a step, right? And so
have you been to Cuba?
I went in 2013. Yes.
So
I have
seen. That's kind of a first step.
Yeah, that was a first step. And so when I went in 2013, I actually went with my cousin, Wilma Rosa, that came in 2004. And I'd always wanted to go, right? Because it goes back to this whole, you know, all these stories and stuff. I wanted to see where my family is from. And I wanted to see where my dad was born and in the house I was born in. And
were they scared for you to go?
Very scared, actually. They were scared for me to go for two reasons, mostly because of what I would see. Right. It's a very different world than it was for them. And I think the second aspect of it is that they were scared as to what could happen for me. And I could go at the time. I could go to Cuba. My father's Cuban. And so I just applied for a visa to be able to go. But I went, the way that I went was interesting. In Miami, they would sell weight in your luggage. And so what you would do is you would take supplies down and you would go essentially as like a supply mule to a certain extent, right? For lack of a better word. And so we would take medicines and clothing and different supplies to families, different families throughout Cuba. And then you would meet somebody in Cuba who would then take your bag and then be able to separate that to the appropriate families. And there'd be other people that would separate that. It was kind of like this sort of like underground supply run there. And so when I went, that's exactly what I did. I only took 10 pounds worth of clothing for me and the rest was supplies for people in need.
Either growing up or even now, when you live in Kansas City and tell people that you are of Cuban descent, how do people tend to react to that? Is there such a thing as a typical response?
There's not a typical response, but what there is there's a typical interest, right? So the first thing that you get, and I'm always usually hesitant to go down this path because there's a kind of sort of like sensitive, painful side to being a Cuban American as well because of why a lot of the people are here. So they ask, oh, Cuba's so great. Like, I want to go to Cuba. I want to, you know, vacation to Cuba. I want to do this. And, you know, it's like at that point I have to decide, how am I going to respond to this person? Am I going to open up this fire hydrant and just deal with this 15 minute conversation that's going to come? Or do I want to kind of go the next route and just say, oh, okay, yeah, and walk away from the conversation?
What do you think it's about that people do have this really strong desire to visit Cuba as tourists?
I think if people want to go to Cuba, I think that they should, right? I want people to experience Cuba for what it is. And it's not a great country. It's not a great country from a political sense, and for the oppressive issues that go on in that country every day. Even that was even documented in April when, you know, the protester was beaten on camera and on an ESPN broadcast. So I want people to go and kind of see that so they can kind of understand. But to a certain extent, I want them to understand that part of the reasoning they want to go is because they have an actual fetishism with poverty, right? And so a lot of people, they have this idea of going to Cuba and they're like, wow, like I need to get to Cuba, right? Because I need to see the real Cuba if and when it ever changes, right? And I think that that's an issue. I think that's an issue, not just in Cuba, but I think in most countries, you know, people wanting to go to Haiti or, you know, people wanting to go to a lot of other, you know, countries in Latin America, Central America. And their reasoning for it is, you know, they want to see, you know, how it looks, right? And a lot of these countries are struggling. And I think, you know, it boils down to just this fetishism of, you know, I don't want to see actual change when it comes to like a business perspective or a political perspective. I want to go and I want to see these dilapidated buildings and I want to see these cars from the 1950s. And I think that is an issue in itself, you know. And I don't think it's unique to Cuba. I think it's unique to really any country, any underdeveloped country too. Because you go to these countries and you take, right? You go to these countries and you take, but you don't really give, right? You go to these countries and you go to these government-owned businesses, you go into these restaurants, and you continue to give money to these governments that are continuing to oppress their people. And you go to Varadero and you spend a really good time at the beach and you have such a great time. You drink mojitos and you smoke cohibas and then you get to leave and you get to go back home to your nice bed in the United States and you get to sleep and sleep with a clean conscience. And then you got to think, you know, a lot of like my relatives, they can't freely leave the country. So in a sense, it's like a big zoo that you're going to visit.
You know, I mean, I think you've already explained this to some extent, but when people in Kansas City talk to you about Cuba, I mean, is there anything that you think that they maybe that it's hard to get if they're not coming from your kind of background?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to get. I mean, in the United States, like I said, you romanticize Cuba and you romanticize Che Guevara or you romanticize Fidel Castro. You romanticize this idea of revolution, right? Because, you know, it's a complete opposite of to what current regimes that we have or have had in our history, right? I mean, dating back to our own revolutions, you know, Civil War or American Revolution. And I think people fall in love with those ideas. And I can't, I don't blame people for coming to me and coming with that perspective because they honestly don't know better. It's not like in the history books, they really drill down deep and talk about these political and socioeconomic issues in Cuba.
You know, with there being so much restriction as far as what can, the communication even between yep. Cuba and the United States, there is very little direct experience that people have been able to have until very, very recently
exactly.
with Cuban culture. And it does seem like maybe music is something that has managed to cross over.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think, I mean, do you think that music has a special role to play as one of the few exports that's made it out of Cuba and into the United States over the last couple of generations?
100%. 100%. I mean, I think the way that you educate people, it's hard to educate people on certain issues and certain, and even culture, if they have no background, right? And two, I've always been a firm believer, two of the biggest ways to do it is by music and by food. And I think once you get people's ear and you get their stomach, then you can get their mind. And I think that's how you get to them. And I think that, you know, music, especially Cuban music, I mean, even look at like in 1997 when, you know, they did the documentary of the Buena Vista Social Club, right? I mean, that got people interested in wanting to know one way or the other, right? And I think that really kind of harkens back to people's interest in wanting to know why things are the way they were. And I think for a certain extent, to certain people, you kind of forgot about Cuba by 1997. I mean, you had the Baceros in 94, you know, which was like a big deal. And then, you know, right after that, you had the issue with Elian Gonzalez. So, I mean, it kind of got people kind of interested again in Cuban music. And honestly, you know, you've got with all the musicians with the Buena Vista Social Club, I mean, these were, I mean, they were kind of all put together, but individually they were all monsters in the musician sense. I mean, they were powerful musicians even alone. So putting them together, it's like putting you know, the Justice League together from like a comic book perspective. And they came out with an incredible record that influenced many then and continues to influence many now.
If you're connected to Cuban culture through music or heritage, call 816-235-2888 to tell us what you want the rest of Kansas City to get about that experience. 816-235-2888. Let's turn now to Bird Fleming, a percussionist from the Traditional Music Society. Bird, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina.
You came to Kansas City from Washington, D.C., having studied Afro-Cuban and Caribbean music. Is that right?
Yes.
What drew you to those musical traditions?
Well, as a youngster, I was, you know, in the fifth grade band in school, I was actually heard melody first. I played the C flute. And I was amazed at my band teacher because he played the drums so well, the set drums, and he's phenomenal. So, and I began to gravitate towards that. And then my first recording of a hand drum, which was bongos, was by an artist called Stevie Wonder. He had a record called Fingertips.
A little known artist called
yes,
Stevie Wonder.
Back in the day. And when I heard the bongos on Fingertips, I said, that's what I want to do, especially since my mom could not afford a complete drum set.
So when you came to Kansas City, what was the scene like for Cuban music, for Afro-Latino music more broadly?
Well, not much, you know, and I had studied Afro-Cuban and African music in Washington, D.C., and then I had gone to out to Berkeley and California, San Francisco to even study a little more, and that's where most of the masters from Cuba had come to in the United States. Rather than going to New York, they went to San Francisco because of the subtropical climate. Then I came to Kansas City after 3 years in San Francisco. So I brought with me ideas and concepts and my instruments as well. And then I began to teach a couple of students here and there. And one thing led to another. My group grew and became an Afro-Cuban group. And it was called La Authentica at first, and then it became Manos. And that group was the group that actually started the rumba scene here. And the icing on the cake was my meeting of my teacher, who was a master drummer, Augustine.
Well, I actually want to share a little bit of a story we've done on Augustine. It's from a while back. He passed away in 2014, mm-hmm. but you did have a close musical relationship with him, and it
yes.
would be hard to talk about the Cuban influence on Kansas
yes.
City music without talking about him. So let's hear a bit of his background, and we'll get back to your take. Okay, Bird?
Mm-hmm.
This is from a story by KCUR's Alex Smith, which he reported when Augustine was still alive.
He explains that back in the Havana of his youth, spontaneous music sessions required only some friends and a little rhythm.
The rumba, it would go from house to house, and we'd say, "Hey, Pablo, get up, Pablo." And the bed frame would become a conga drum. And the drawer, we'd take out the drawer, empty it out, and it becomes another drum. Oh, and your wife, she cooks for us. And tomorrow, we go to my house or another house, and nobody gets mad.
Augustine Romero Diaz remembers the music of his youth as a community experience. Percussionists would play percussion, singers would sing, and dancers would dance. And the whole neighborhood would pitch in to fuel the sessions with a hearty communal soup.
We would take an old lard bucket, and the old people worked together to make ajiaco or soup for all the rumberos. They would put in whatever they had, chicken, vegetables, potatoes, yams, and meat. We would get a little something to drink from the corner store, and we'd be ready for the rumba.
Afro-Cuban music is considered to be some of the purest expression of African culture in the Western Hemisphere. It was brought to the island by Africans who came as slaves from present-day countries such as Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Cameroon. The blacks of Cuba were able to maintain their culture through secret societies like the Abakwa. Many of these secret African cultural and religious groups survive to this day. Romero Diaz's conservative family, however, did not approve of his interest in Afro-Cuban music or African culture.
No lo aprendí, ahora lo aprendí cuando era niño.
I learned rumba when I was a child, but my mama didn't approve. But the elders told her, leave him with us. He has black blood. He needs to learn this.
Despite his family's disapproval, Agustin Romero Diaz became accomplished in styles from all over Cuba, including the religious Santeria music, the carnival music called Congo, and the Spanish-influenced rumba of Guaguancó. He was still a kid learning music in the streets in 1959 when Fidel Castro led a revolt to overthrow dictator Fulgencio Batista. Our translator, Pablo La Rosa, explains how Castro's policies of the revolution changed music in the streets.
He's told me before that that Castro did clamp down on spontaneous music playing. This is not part of the interview, but this is from what he's told me before, because Castro saw this as a threat to the order. when people play music like that spontaneously, they become quite independent. So he did control. Castro, he always blames Castro, but you know the powers that be control the music making.
By the time he was 18, Romero Diaz could play with the best in Cuba, and he did. He joined the band of Tata Guines, known as the King of Congos and one of the greatest percussionists of all times. Here's Tata Guines playing with the group Cubanismo. In 1980, a struggling economy and international political pressure led Fidel Castro to announce that anyone who wanted to leave Cuba would be allowed to do so. From April until October, about 125,000 Cubans, including Agustin Romero Diaz, took a 90-mile boat trip to the United States.
That was KCUR's Alex Smith with the story of Cuban musician Agustin Romero Diaz, who came here as part of the Mariel boat lift and died in 2014. Bird Fleming, how did you meet Agustin, and tell me your perspective on his influence on Kansas City music?
Well, one of my first students, who was from Colombia, South America, Olson Marin, worked at the time Alameda Plaza Hotel, which is not a intercontinental hotel, big hotel. He was a waiter there. He worked in the kitchen and went along with some other Cuban guys. And he was a part, Olson, my student, was a part of our group as well. So he was singing a rumba song in the kitchen. And one of the Cuban guys says, oh, what do you know about rumba? What do you think? What are you singing about rumba? And he says, well, you're not part of a group, and we play rumba. I got congas and bongs, et cetera. He says, well, we know a guy named Agustin who's really a good rumbetta. So Olson said, yeah, I'd like to meet him. And so he came over to my house, which we had the rumba on McGee Street. And he was the missing link to everything we were trying to do. And, of course, I had experience with rumba, but he was the icing on the cake.
What is rumba?
Rumba is the rural music and dance that's done spontaneously by the Cubans. It's of African descent, bought by the Bantu people. And it's the term comes from a Spanish word, you know. And actually, it's representative of a gathering of the community and the families to play music spontaneously. And songs are associated with the music, and also there's a dance as well, a courtship dance between a man and a woman. So he was singing the song, and then Agustin came by. Agustin had previously come by, but not came into the door just to listen to us.
We're going to hear more of that story when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. In KCUR Central Standard returns, the rest of the story of how Agustin Romero Diaz shaped Kansas City music, and we'll broaden that conversation about Afro-Latino musical traditions. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR Central Standard. Today's show is about the Cuba-Kansas City connection. We've heard from Antonio Marquez about his story as a second-generation Cuban-American, and we've been talking about music with Bird Fleming, a percussionist from the Traditional Music Society. He was just telling us the story of how Antonio Romero Diaz shaped music in Kansas City. How is his influence still felt here?
Agustin.
Agustin. Excuse me.
That's okay. Well, he actually began to take us under his wings as students and gave us the purest in essence of what rumba was all about, the technique on the conga drums, the connection between all the rhythms, the polyrhythmic concept, which is an African concept, and all the percussive instruments, and how we orchestrate that into various different styles from Cuba, not only a rumba, but guaguancó, bolero, cha-cha-cha, danzón, and these are all musical styles and genres accompanied with a dance, and conga, and apacuá, and palo mayombe. All of these different styles come out of this little teeny little island, and they're great orchestrations, and all of them tell this story. So he was about, and then later on, you know, I met him in the early 80s, and through the 90s, I studied with him for about 20 years. And then other rumberos, you know, you get that title when you came and joined us, Bill was a part of it. So a lot of musicians came out of that, and they've gone on to actually have their own expressions through different Latin jazz groups and salsa groups. My friend Michael De Leon had a group called Flamante and Mambo X back in the day. My friend Pablo La Rosa is presently with the group Latin Jazz All-Stars. And this has actually made the Latin music scene really, really prominent because all these men have really taken the rumba style and the essence of Cuban style into their contemporary Latin styles.
Tell me a little bit about your own heritage and how that connects you possibly to the music that you perform.
Well, you know, hearsay is that my father was from Cuba. The jury is still out on that, probably more like West Indies, you know. My mom was in Miami at the time of my birth, or my conception. She was probably trying to find love in all the wrong places. But I consider myself African-American with that influence. But I've always drawn to the music and drawn to percussion. And so I've played this music through probably six presidencies, and I'm still doing, and six economies, and I'm still surviving. So
that's a funny way to measure.
I don't know why I do that. So, and I've taken my musical style, and in addition to Afro-Cuban, African, West African music, and Brazilian samba music is all a part of my organization, the Traditional Music Society, where we use our music for arts and education in the schools and community.
I want to bring another voice in on this conversation, jazz musician Pablo Sanhueza. Hi, Pablo.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your background and the history that you personally bring to jazz.
I came to Kansas City in 1996, and it was a moment in which Afro-Cuban music was getting a lot of attention from the mainstream media because of the success of the Buena Vista Social Club movie. That put, again, Cuban music into the mainstream, into the popular consciousness. And the local bands who were doing this music, at the time Son Venezuela and Mambo X, benefited from this impulse. It fits perfectly with this story that we're finding the missing pieces here of this story. I was very young when I came, and it was an incredible opportunity for me to join Latin American music. I'm from Chile. I came from Chile. My parents were political exiles, and it took a long time for us to reunite. That's a very similar story too. My parents were exiled from the opposite side of the spectrum. They were officers of the socialist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. And the coup d'etat dispersed many Chileans throughout the world. And when I came here, in this moment of popularity of Latin American music, this helped me to find direction in a moment of disenchantment with rock music.
You were personally disenchanted with rock music?
Yeah, I grew up with rock music in Chile because Latin American music was forbidden there. After the coup d'etat, Latin American music and Latin American culture was removed from the mainstream because of this neoliberal the Chicago Boys took over the economy in Chile and they imported neoliberalism. We were the experiment in Chile. And American culture was what these economists wanted to model Chile in particular.
So you got to reconnect or maybe even connect for the first time with this music?
Reconnect, because in an underground level, we had to hide to listen to Latin American music. It was forbidden by the fascist dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, a far-right dictator, one of the most brutal after Franco in the history of the 20th century. So Latin American was forbidden in Chile, especially music that talk about Latin American liberation in the romantic terms that we are speaking of in the 60s, you know, in this Latin American revolution narrative that was developed there, you know.
So people here were kind of fascinated in this moment with Afro-Latino music.
Yes.
How did you connect with that music here? I mean, what did you think of what you saw? Was it inspiring?
It was very inspiring to see, because my disappointment with rock music when I was here, when I saw what it really was, that it was more entertainment than anything, it drove me back to these cultural gatherings that Latinos had in the 90s in Kansas City through the cultural organizations that every country had. And this music existed in these spaces, in the cultural arts. It hadn't totally made it up to the commercial world of bars and venues and festivals. It was the transition had started in that moment because of the relevance of this movie and the mainstream attention on the Buena Vista Social Club. So the bands who were doing this music in Kansas City benefited from this impulse. And this music had an opportunity to have a commercial presence in Kansas City, in Westport, in the jazz district, and the more savvy band leaders managed to put this music in cultural festivals across the Midwest, not just in Kansas City.
You attended the conservatory, right?
Yes, I attended the conservatory, but much after that, I came in '96 and I joined the music scene as an apprentice. They need a percussionist, and I joined in immediately. Some Venezuela. I played for Mambo de León, and I started my own band with younger people.
And the conservatory, I mean, when you studied jazz, did you come to view Kansas City jazz as having just at its core any Latin influence, any Afro-Latin influence in particular?
At the moment, it didn't. It was a very interesting situation. One of the musicians in the band suggested me to audition for the conservatory and go and meet Bobby Watson, who had just moved back to Kansas City from New York and who has background in Afro-Latin music. So he thought this the new director of jazz studies is a very hip cat, and he's going to really pay attention to what you're doing, and this is an opportunity for you to show what you have.
I want to get Bird Fleming's take on this. You know, what do you think in the story of Kansas City jazz, where would you put the Cuban influence, the Afro-Latin influence?
In terms of the style itself, Kansas City jazz?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I, if you're down at the Mutual Musicians Foundation, which is downtown 18th and Vine, which is kind of like the stepchild of the 18th and Vine district, it's around the corner. You know, back in the dark, in the corner, but a very, very historical, probably the most historical institution down there.
The cool stepchild.
Yes, cool stepchild. If you go down there in the atrium or the main lobby, the main club area where the white piano is, look on the walls and look at some of those pictures and you see guys with bongos.
I want to play a little Charlie Parker as long as we're talking about Kansas City jazz. This is his Afro-Cuban suite.
Mm-hmm.
What are we hearing, Bird?
Yeah, I think this is a Mario Bauza.
Mario Bauza.
Yeah, Mario Bauza was the Cuban guy that came here with Chano Pozo. And they put together the first Latin jazz group in New York, I think in mid-40s, you know, late 40s. And this is a classic. And they hired, Charlie Parker being from Kansas City, it was monumental that he was a part of the Latin scene, this Latin jazz scene, the very first experiment with that, being from Kansas City. So that says a lot. So there's your connection, one of the connections I would say that Kansas City has with this genre.
Pablo, what are you hearing?
I'm hearing bolero, and yeah, this is definitely Afro-Cuban music and the fusion of jazz. And most definitely, Charlie Parker, when he went to New York City, that's when he made Afro-Cuban jazz traditional. But in the origin of jazz, since the times of New Orleans, there is what they call the Latin tinge in there. So yeah, it has been present. The Afro-Caribbean music has been present in jazz from its inception, and maybe in Kansas City, the stronger influence into Latin jazz came in the 90s when through Agustin that generated. But I don't think that before there was much Afro-Cuban music before Agustin.
No.
There's definitely a before and after Agustin. Agustin really helped us to bridge that gap and bring Afro-Cuban music into jazz since the 90s.
Well, we are going to get right back to this conversation about Cuban culture and Afro-Latino music in Kansas City when we return. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been talking about Cuban culture and Afro-Latino music in Kansas City. Music has been a big focus of this conversation, but we're interested in people's stories more broadly. We've been chatting with Bird Fleming, Pablo Sanhueza, and Antonio Marquez. Hi again, everyone.
Hi.
Antonio, you've been listening politely as we've delved deep into the music part of this discussion. What's been going through your mind?
I mean, it's beautiful. I'm very much musically motivated, I should say. unfortunately, when it comes to a lot of Latin music, you know, I'm very surface level with a lot of it. And it just has to do with the fact that, you know, I grew up here. And so, I mean, if we were talking about, you know, punk music, I could tell you several things about punk music and the emergence of punk music. I can tell you about punk music in Latin America. But, you know, when it comes to a lot of like the traditional music from Cuba, like I said, I know very surface level stuff, but I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you know, two people here that, you know, are not Cuban, but you can tell they're extremely passionate about the music. And like I said before, I think music has no boundaries. It has no, there's no political divide. There's no issue. It unites. It is, it creates interest. It's love. It's great.
Pablo, is that how you see music? Do you think that politics can come into music, even when you think about going to hear Kansas City jazz or any kind of music in Kansas City where the Afro-Latino influence is felt?
I think it does erase differences because it happens in the bands that we play with. We have very different ideas, totally opposite ideas in the political spectrum, but we have enough respect for each other's views and we can work together. And I think that is a message that should be emulated, you know, should be, you know, repeated. In the bands that we work with, since they are diverse in national origin, social class, there is complete different world views many times in the band room and in the band stage, musically even, and jazz serves to find that common ground among all of us. Mm-hmm. It's a language that serves as a reminder of the common ground that we all stand on.
It's a compromise.
Explain that more. What do you mean by it's a compromise?
Well, it's probably the epitome of actual cultural negotiation. You've got to come together. You've got to be able to understand the rhythm that's being played and understand the melodic line that lays over the top of it and the harmonic structure and the presentation and all that. You got to set your belief systems aside to actually get that done, to do presentations.
Do you think that the questions about who owns what kind of music can come up, or is it on some level all music belongs to everyone? Is it more complicated than that?
Well, yeah, one of my teachers from Africa said, because we are now in a world in the millennium that everybody plays everybody else's music. You know, I met a lady in a school gig one time before I went on. She was playing Dakoto, African-American lady. She was on Dakoto as a Japanese string instrument. And she was dressed in her kimono and the whole garb scene. And I said, I'd never seen a black Japanese woman before. But she wasn't Japanese. She was African-American. But she played it well, you know. So in the millennium now, you can expect that. You know, you can expect that crossover because people are really interested and actually take just as much passion with other people's culture as people themselves.
I think I totally agree with Berses. I would like to add that the claim, you can own or claim or make part of you any music of the world, but you need to pay the dues.
What do you mean by pay the dues?
You need to learn the culture. You know, you can just buy a djembe at the market and call yourself a djembe player. You need to study the djembe, and you need to study not with YouTube. You need to search for a teacher. And hopefully this teacher is from the source. And so he can show you the detailed information that is not in YouTube, because this is not just the rhythm. The rhythms have a meaning, and this meaning is lost in the translation if your source is not legit. So I absolutely believe that anybody has the, as anybody has the right to live in any place on earth that they decide. Anybody could take on any tradition, but honor that tradition and really do it. Don't claim something that you just YouTubed about.
Seems kind of cool.
The
YouTube Conservatory of Music can be helpful if you have a connection with the culture, because it can help you, you know, repeat certain things. Like, for example, I'm learning to play now blues bass. I bought a bass guitar and I'm learning the blues. But I'm YouTubing stuff. I'm in the YouTube Conservatory of Music right now. But the moment that I'm going to consider myself a legit blues, aspiring bluesman, is when I can hold my part in a jam session at the many legit venues that are in Kansas City to play the blues. They are everywhere.
And you'd be seeking out a mentor?
Of course. I already do. In my band, every musician have conservatory studies. So when I grab the bass, I'm studying with my bass player. When I study piano, I'm studying with my piano player. If I want to learn about jazz, you go to the jam sessions and follow the tradition. But you can you can claim a tradition that you're not part of. That's all. That's all. But I really believe in the right of anybody to claim to live in anywhere in the world you want to live, to endorse any culture, any belief that you want to endorse, as long as you're not harming anybody else.
Antonio, you have been nodding very enthusiastically. Are there other aspects of culture beyond music where you think it needs to get past the superficial and you need that people maybe need to understand what it is they're enjoying a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, man, Pablo hit it right on the head. I mean, 100%. I think, you know, we live in a time where I think there's, you know, absolute freedom, like Pablo said, to, you know, live wherever you want and play whatever music you want. And that's a beautiful thing, right? But then you talk like a really fine line on cultural appropriation, right? You have to be kind of genuine in your intentions. I think, you know, you can't really decide on, you know, if someone's appropriating your culture or not. It's a really hard thing to kind of figure out, but you can tell usually within the first few minutes of meeting somebody or seeing someone play music live, whether or not, you know, is this the real version? Are we getting the Pepsi? Or are we getting the Diet Pepsi? Right? Are we getting the full flavor here? You know, so I think that's something that, you know, is something people should be conscious about. But I think if you know, if that's something that you're interested in, I think that do it, but go head on into it and dive into it and understand the culture, understand why it is and where it came from.
We've got to get out of here, but Bird, if you were going to give some quick advice on how to do that, who would you go to for that genuine lesson in Kansas City?
Well, there are a lot of mentors. There are a lot of Augustinitos, as I call them. You know, me, Pablo Sanhueza, Pat Conway, you know, and those are probably your three people who can probably help you out a lot.
Our time is up for today's show. Bird Fleming of the Traditional Music Society, thanks for being here. Jazz musician Pablo Sanhueza, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Antonio Marquez, it's been great hearing your story.
Thank you very much.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there, and you will never miss an episode. Tomorrow, we'll be remembering Tom Poe, whose voice used to be a part of our movie critics circle. He was a quiet but powerful force in Kansas City's film, teaching, LGBT, and faith communities. Tune in for that remembrance. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Todd Hope, and Jen Chen and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.